We're just about there, and we are ready to break down Conference Championship Sunday, the Final Four, how the Patriots will deal with Le'Veon Bell, whether the Steelers' young D can hold Tom Brady in check, red-hot Aaron Rodgers and his depleted team, and how they can keep pace with Matt Ryan and company in Atlanta, plus big mailbag, including some coach talk and some second-guessing of the Cowboys. All that and much more on the MMQB 10 Things NFL Look Ahead podcast.
The MMQB presents the MMQB 10 Things podcast, powered by digital media. Find your voice. And now, your hosts, Andy Benoit and Gary Gramling.
Hello and welcome to the MMQB 10 Things NFL Look Ahead podcast. I am Gary Gramling. He is Andy Benoit. We've been the same guys all season. We're still here. But we are now talking conference championship football. We were at the Final Four. Andy, you know, a year ago, Super Bowl 50, Panthers-Broncos, those are two teams, despite Cam Newton and Peyton Manning, those were defense first. Those were their identities were defensive-minded teams. This year, our Final Four, all four teams much better on offense than they are on defense.
Oh, it's a great collection of quarterbacks, obviously, in this Final Four, and I would expect that NFC Championship game, I would put the over-under at 70 points in that one, total points. You know, New England actually finished number one in defense on points a game allowed, but offense, yeah, which surprised me. I mean, I knew they were very good, but they did it by, they were 2.2 points better. So they averaged 15.6 allowed. The Giants were second best at 17.8. That's a dominant defensive season for them, but you're right. It's going to be their offense that probably decides the game, and same with Pittsburgh.
It is. And we're actually gonna start with that game right now. This is the AFC title game. The Pittsburgh Steelers will travel to Foxborough and play the New England Patriots. If you didn't already know that, you probably knew it from like Antonio Brown's Facebook video or something like that. This is another one. We've seen a lot of these this postseason. Another rematch, but back in week 7 when the Patriots went to Pittsburgh and won 27-16, there was no Ben Roethlisberger. And weirdly enough, when these teams met in the 2015 opener, Patriots won that game 28-21. There was no Le'Veon Bell in that game. He was suspended at the time. So the big question when you're talking Steelers offense versus anyone at this point is Le'Veon Bell and how is an opponent going to stop Le'Veon Bell? Patriots held him to 81 yards last time, but again, you know, when it's Landry Jones and not Ben back there, there's, you know, you can focus on the ground game a little bit more. Andy, the way the Steelers are running the ball right now, can the Patriots slow this team down?
It's interesting. That's going to decide the game on that side of the ball, because I think there is unequivocally no question about it now. Pittsburgh is a run-first team. They're a running offense. That's what they morphed into. After that game with Landry Jones, they entered the second half of the season, and they started doing more 6 offensive line sets, multi-tight end sets. They're not just a running offense. They're a smash-mouth running offense. And I think we'll see that in this game. Last week against Kansas City, they did the opposite. They went 3 wide receivers almost every snap. And they knew that the Chiefs would go dime, so they'd be very light, and they'd go 2 high safeties against that. So they wanted to run against Kansas City's light box. The game, it took an interesting turn, Gary. In fact, I think if the game had been another quarter long, if it had been a 5-quarter game, it may have tilted towards Kansas City, because what the Chiefs did in that one was go to a 3-4 front in the fourth quarter. And as soon as they did that, the whole tenor changed. Pittsburgh's running game dried up, and it was a different flow. The reason that's important is because New England runs a 3-4 front. And really, when we say 3-4, if it's a nickel defense, which we're talking about, it's a 5-1. It's 5 guys up and 1 stack linebacker. But Steelers were not great running against that against New England or against Kansas City. New England's going to show them that front. And so I think Pittsburgh's response will be less 3 wide receiver sets, back to the multi-tight end sets, and we're going to try to create more gaps up front and see how that goes.
So you mentioned a minute ago the Patriots being the number one scoring defense in football. I'm just going to quickly run down the quarterbacks they face this year, because, I mean, honestly, this was not a stellar murderer's row of opposing QBs. They played Carson Palmer and then Ryan Tannehill early on. Then they got Osweiler, Tyrod Taylor. They got the duo of Whitehurst and Kessler. Andy Dalton, Landry Jones, Tyrod again, Russell Wilson, of course, had a big night against them. That was the only Tom Brady loss this year. They got Kaepernick, Fitzpatrick, Goff, Flacco, Semien. They got the Petty Fitzpatrick duo. They got Matt Moore, and they got Brock Osweiler in their first postseason game. I mean, I think it's not a hot take to say that Ben Roethlisberger is better than everyone on that list. He's going to be the best quarterback they'll have faced this year. Ben missed a couple throws last week. We've talked about his weird home road splits, and look, it sort of came out last week. He did miss a couple throws that he should have made. Do you even entertain the fact of sort of trying to trying to catch the Patriots off guard a little bit and maybe opening it up through the air a little bit more?
Probably not, because you want to, when you run the ball, in theory, you're keeping Tom Brady off the field, keeping the clock moving, and that's not the worst thing ever. I mean, it's not like you have to do that. They may not even think of it that way. But I don't know if you come. I don't think they're going to come out and just catch the Patriots off guard, or even think of it that way either. They're an execution offense, though. They're not a spread offense anymore. So they're not as schemed in the passing game as before. And I think it's going to be an execution game. I don't think you're going to outsmart anybody. And what's interesting is New England's a very execution-oriented defense as well. We think of them as being multiple, and they are pretty multiple, but they don't do a ton of disguises and trickery with it. They're multiple, but in that they change what they do from snap to snap, but they don't show you one look and rotate into something else. They don't do that a whole bunch, not compared to the rest of the league. So who tackles best, who blocks best? This is football 101 for the AFC Championship on this side of the ball.
Nice. That'll be fun to watch. We don't see that a whole lot anymore. Flipping over to the other side of the ball, I'll give the Bill O'Brien quote after the divisional round game, in which the Texans, look, they gave the Patriots a run for their money a little bit, and you know, a lot of that had to do with the success they had on the defensive side of the ball against Brady and company. But O'Brien said afterwards, quote, "We know they're very well coached, so you can't be vanilla. They've got vanilla. You've got to figure out something else to do and some different things. If you line up in the same front you did last week, they're going to block the crap out of you." Now, we've talked all season about the Steelers. They sort of had that, they have a couple rookies in there in the secondary. It's a younger defense. It's uncharacteristically young for a Steelers defense. How flexible can they get at this point of the season? Because obviously these guys have had, we're in January now. They've had 18 games to sort of get their feet under them.
Well, I think you can divide it into two parts of the defense, and really what O'Brien's talking about there is the front seven. And and within the context of this conversation, it's a little bit separate from the secondary. You can mix up your front seven and not have to rely a whole lot more on your young secondary than you have and other times. There's some overlap. Sometimes if we do this front, the safety has to do that. There's a little bit of overlap. But what O'Brien did that worked very well against New England, he had two movable pieces, and it was the same pieces he's moved around all season long, or Romeo Crennel's moved around. It's Jadeveon Clowney and Whitney Mercilus. And they moved them even on first down, which I don't know if I've seen that ever, and certainly not against running teams. New England would line up in a running formation, an I formation or two tight ends, and the Texans treated it as if it were a third down and seven, and they're moving their pieces around, and it worked for them. New England never got their ground game going. Now, two things. One, they did it. Houston did it with Jadeveon Clowney. Does Pittsburgh have a Jadeveon Clowney? If they do, it would be in the form of Ryan Shazier. So do they feel like they can use him that way? The difference is Shazier does not line up on the line of scrimmage the way Clowney does. So you're already talking about less movability. And the other thing is Houston has Vince Wilfork and DJ Reader, and New England could not get those two moved in the ground game. Does Pittsburgh have an answer for that? I think Justin Hargrave's been tremendous, but he's more of a nimble nose tackle than a gap plugging, stalemating nose tackle like a Will Fork would be. So it's just a little bit of a different style of defense. And I would imagine Pittsburgh's going to show you different looks as well. They're not going to go as crazy with it as Houston did, mm-hmm. but they do change up and often involves one guy rotating after the snap. So the front that they show you at the snap, one of those pieces is likely to move after the snap. You don't know which piece it will be. Timmons and Shazier are usually involved in that equation, and that's what Tom Brady's going to have to sort out. And he'll have to sort it out on first down, second down, and especially on third down.
The last two games these teams matched up, going back to the Week 7 matchup this year and the opener a year ago, there were big games for Gronkowski, and there were big games with a lot of confusion in the Pittsburgh secondary. With no Gronk and with Martellus Bennett, maybe a little bit hampered with a knee injury. I mean, can you create the same type of chaos in that Steelers secondary that they have the last two times?
Yes, you can, because you know where those Steelers secondary players, those back seven players, are going to be. The Steelers mm-hmm. are almost exclusively a zone defense, and it's cover two or it's cover three. They don't do a lot of hybrid coverages. They don't do a lot of different man-to-man stuff. So you, and out of their cover three, sometimes they'll match up in man out of it, but you still know who's going to be where on defense. And Lawrence Timmons is the guy they'll go after. They're going to try to isolate him. And in that Week 7 game, I know Gronkowski finished with big numbers. He had some long catches in the second half. But I thought really the defining element of that game was the way New England got its wide receivers inside at the shallow levels. They went after the linebackers with their wide receivers, which has been the foundation of New England's offense for many years now. What's different about this New England offense than the others, though, is that they're more vertical than they were. And if you look at the numbers, Tom Brady has thrown downfield a lot more and a lot better than he did a year ago. I mean, his passer rating on deep throws is up about 35 or 40%.
Yeah.
And it's a more vertical offense. So when they attack Timmons and when they attack Shazier, I would imagine they're going to try to go deep down the middle against them. But I would think it'll be with wide receivers more than tight ends. Bennett will be part of the equation, but it's going to be your Edelmans, your Amendolas, those guys. Chris Hogan, of course, those are their guys now.
All right, Andy. Anything else you want to touch on with the AFC game?
I think we're good. I liked what Bill Belichick had to say about home field advantage and how it, you know, ask Dallas and Kansas City how important it is. Belichick does not play around, and we know that. But he keeps saying players win the games. It matters. The bye week stuff doesn't matter. Experience, that stuff, it doesn't matter. Just go out there and play. I like the message.
Yeah, that's good.
Bill Belichick's a good message deliverer. That's the takeaway from that. I mean, that's a good. Wow.
He's a pretty good coach too. We'll go out on a limb on that. I think there's something to be said for home field if you're talking about indoor teams having to play a different style, going outside in elements or something like that. But obviously that's not going to play in with either of these games this weekend. But let's move on to the other game, and that is the Green Bay Packers at the Atlanta Falcons. Again, this is another rematch, Week 8 in Atlanta. This was a fun one. This was, if you play fantasy football, if you enjoy lots of points, this one was for you. This was Falcons 33, Packers 32 at the end. It was very much a who has the ball last type of game. But let's start with Aaron Rodgers and the Packers offense versus Falcons defense here. Now we've discussed the absence of Desmond Trufant and what it's meant for this Falcons secondary. Do they sit back and cover three this week? I mean they had some trouble. I know you're going to talk about over routes right here, Andy. Is that something they do, or do they switch it over to man?
I would be shocked if they don't switch to man, because what happened in the first game against Green Bay, it was like there were two different games. And in the first game, the Falcons played cover three and Aaron Rodgers carved them up. And in the second game, the Falcons went to man-to-man, did different versions of man-to-man, but it was pure man-to-man across the board. And Green Bay was totally stifled. We know how they've struggled against man at times. Atlanta dominated once they went man to man. So I would imagine they will stick with that. And as far as the problem with the cover three stuff, and they've gotten much better on it. You mentioned over routes. What we're talking about are slot receivers running deep and diagonally across the field. And that seems awfully specific, but every team has done that to Atlanta this season because those rookie linebackers are responsible for guarding that route. And they've been very up and down there. And Green Bay got them with this several times. A Jordy Nelson 58-yard catch early in the game set the tone. That was against Keanu Neal, the rookie safety. But Campbell and Jones have struggled with that early in the season, and teams have gone after it to exploit their lack of awareness and just to get their wide receivers matched up on a linebacker downfield. We just talked about New England's going to do that against Pittsburgh. To the credit of those rookies, and I think to the immense credit of Dan Quinn, they've been much sounder in the second half of the season, and they were very good against those concepts against Seattle. You didn't notice them because nobody threw the ball because those over routes got covered. So it was if they want to go cover three, I suppose they can. They're a better cover three defense now than the first half of the season, but they're a better defense in man-to-man against Green Bay and the way they match up. So I would still be surprised if man-to-man's not their foundation, especially on third downs.
Yeah, and it looks like Jordy Nelson and Davante Adams are both looking pretty questionable. Maybe Adams with a little better chance of suiting up than Nelson this week. They didn't have Jared Cook last time, if I remember correctly, when these two teams met. Is he a difference maker? I mean, you figure Cobb would take on sort of the Jordy Nelson role in this one, and Cook adds something of an element here.
Yeah, and really, they didn't have Cobb or Montgomery either in that last game. So it's a totally different Packers offense because Cook, Montgomery, and Cobb, those are their three most flexible pieces. And they're so much more diverse in their formations when they have those guys, even just one or two of them, Cook especially, which is another reason I think we'll see Atlanta go man-to-man because that's one way to offset those mismatches. If you go zone, then those formations become a problem because it gets harder for the zone defenders to read them. If you're in man-to-man, in theory, you're only reading the man you're defending. You don't have to read the whole offense. So I would imagine we'll see it's not a rematch in that sense, Gary, because it's such a different Packers offense.
It is.
With who they have on the field. And then, of course, with the way Rodgers is playing. He was not playing well when he went into that game last time, and right now he's playing better than any QB I've ever seen.
I was going to say that the backfield for the Packers in that game, it was a whole lot of Aaron Ripkowski, Don Jackson, and a little bit of Niall Davis sprinkled in. So you'll see some Ripkowski this weekend, but certainly not to the same extent. And then those other two guys are obviously not a factor. They had Rodgers run for 60 yards, and that was it for their ground game, pretty much.
And you know what was interesting is when they came out early in that game as well, even though they were without Randall Cobb and without Cook, they still spread out, and they often went four or sometimes even five wide receivers. And when they went four wide receivers, usually it's Ripkowski is the running back in because he's their best pass-blocking running back. So if Atlanta sees Ripkowski again, chances are Green Bay will be in a spread set and trying to get to the bottom of Atlanta's cornerbacking depth chart and work in those matchups. I don't know if they can do that if Nelson and Adams are both out. I mean, that would leave him with Geronimo Allison, Randall Cobb, Jeff Janis, and I guess who's the guy from Cal that you love? Trevor Davis?
Oh, Trevor Davis.
Yeah. So, I mean, maybe they could. They did it last time, but just something to keep in mind. It'll be very interesting to see who Green Bay puts on the field and how Atlanta lines up in response.
I don't love Trevor Davis, by the way. I think he's a nice guy. He went coat shopping with Emily Kaplan for a piece a couple weeks ago, but
yeah, you
I love
know
where
him.
That
it's
comes
fine.
From. Love him.
You mentioned him a few weeks ago. You brought him up, and you wouldn't let it go.
Oh boy, he drew a pass interference. I think that's what it was.
Yeah, that's what it was. We were arguing about the PA. It's against the Lions. I remember now. Yeah, that was a bad call too. I hadn't seen it at the time that we were arguing about it. It was Sunday night. I hadn't seen it yet, and I watched that film on Wednesday. I recall and thinking, "Oh man, Gary was."
That was a 66 yarder, right?
Yeah, it was.
Oh, that was way back in there. I feel like that was like September almost.
Yeah.
Last thing I wanted to ask you about that side of the ball. So no Trufant this time, and you have these Packers receivers obviously with no Nelson and potentially no Adams, or I should say potentially no Nelson. We don't know that for sure yet. It's not a great group. So if you're matched up man though, no Desmond Trufant in there. You also have the Packers offensive line, who is, and we talked about a week ago, how would the Seahawks hold up against this Falcons pass rush? Packers have held up in pass protection all year, and we've sort of talked about how the Falcons pass rush maybe doesn't match up to the box score stats that they put up. Does that give you any pause if you're Dan Quinn? Would you opt to sit back zone, or is that just going to exacerbate the problem if the pass rush can't get home?
I would opt to sit back in man with some guys sitting back in zone. I would rush three, and I would keep two free defenders plus a quarterback spy on Rodgers, which kind of serves as an extra free defender. And that's what they did last time, too, and it worked okay for them. The Trufant thing, you know, Robert Alford's played pretty well, and he was tremendous last week. He's kind of just gradually, as the season's gone on, and especially last week, he's kind of just assumed the Trufant duties, and he traveled with Doug Baldwin and won that matchup. So you just got, if you're going to be a man-to-man defense, especially, you just have to go with the next man up in that case. And they've been without Trufant now for half the season. So these are their corners. Jalen Collins, that's their guy. Robert Alford's their guy. Brian Poole. They're going to compete. And I think those guys, for the most part, have overachieved or been very solid.
All right. Flipping it to the other side of the ball. It kind of looks like it doesn't matter who the Falcons run out there as their skill position guys anymore. Just the play designs and with the way Matt Ryan is going, they are going to move the ball. So Julio Jones aggravated the toe injury last week. It looks like he'll be fine and he'll play at whatever his full strength is at this point of the season. But when these teams met back in October, you know, Jones was obviously he was drawing a lot of coverage. He drew a couple penalties. But he only had three catches in this game, and they certainly still moved the ball at will without Julio Jones having a monster game. They also had no Tevin Coleman in this one. It was Teron Ward was actually there. Not only filled in for Coleman, but was actually their leading rusher in this one. So, you know, this Packers secondary, they're running out guys who, well, they're not great. They're not. They don't have a guy who you'd look at and say, "Well, there's your number one who matches up with Julio Jones." So I guess ultimately, how do you counter what the Falcons are going to throw at you in the passing game?
Well, what Green Bay will do, I don't know if there's an easy answer for this. For one, Atlanta, did you know they're 6-0 in games where Julio Jones has like three or fewer catches or below 50 yards or something like that? When he doesn't get a lot of production, they've been very good because they're built to spread the ball around. And if he's not getting production, it's always because he's getting double teamed very deliberately. And if you double team a guy deliberately, then you simplify the coverage elsewhere, and that makes it even harder to go up against a guy like Matt Ryan who will dissect your coverages. What they'll do is, I think what they did last time and what they've done the last few weeks, and that's use Ladarius Gunter as the underneath man-to-man defender against Jones, and then roll the safety to that side over the top against him. And how about if you're Ladarius Gunter? You were probably expected to be the number four corner on the team. And in these postseason games, you've gone up against Beckham and traveled with him, and then Dez Bryant, and then Julio Jones. And if you win, you might go up against Antonio Brown next week, which would probably be in the next game, I mean. That'd probably be the best four-receiver slate any cornerback's ever faced in a row in NFL history. Now, he's not doing it alone, and he can't do it alone.
Yeah.
And the problem is when you double and give the guy help like that, we've said you make everything else easier to read. And there's also the issue of who else do they have at corner right now, because Rollins has been up in the air. He hasn't been healthy. Randall is becoming a bigger liability each week, and he struggled outside and in the slot last week. And that's probably where Matt Ryan's going to go with the football. Green Bay just does not have a lot of depth in their secondary.
Yep. Well, I will actually pass this last question off to – this is – James Vouse on Twitter at jvouse1979 simply asks, with Shanahan's diverse offensive attack, diverse offense attacking Ds at all levels across the field, is there a particular way you expect the Falcons to attack the Packers on Sunday?
I mean, it depends what the if it's man to man coverage, then they'll use rub routes and crossing patterns and tactics like that try to force defenders to run into each other. And the other part we haven't talked about, Gary, that I think will be a factor is the running game. And they're a zone running team, and they're an outside zone running team in Atlanta, and so is Dallas. And we wondered, because Green Bay plays a 4-2, they don't play a 4-3 or a 3-4, it's a 4-2 defense, and they ask a lot of their interior defensive linemen to win. But when you line up in a 4-2, it's harder to run outside zone against it because of where the defensive tackles line up. So Atlanta's going to have to be an inside zone running team. Dallas had about 140 yards almost running inside zone against Green Bay. But when you watched that divisional round game, did you ever feel like Dallas was really owning or dictating the game with their rushing attack?
No, I mean, they stuck with it, and that's sort of what stuck out. But, you know, it was kind of like the Packers didn't exactly go into a shell, but it was kind of like, you know, all right, well, if you guys are going to run it for 8 yards here, you know, the clock is our friend more than it's your friend, so we're gonna let you do some deliberate drives.
Yeah. And watching the film on it after seeing the TV, Dallas had good yards, but it never felt like their running game dictated the game or really defined anything. And I would imagine Green Bay wants Atlanta to run the ball, and Atlanta probably knows Green Bay wants it, and they saw the Dallas game, and it'll be interesting to see when the Packers stay back in their two shell coverages. Do the Falcons, who have a veteran quarterback who makes good checks at the line of scrimmage, do they try to throw the ball anyway, or do they do what you're supposed to do mathematically on the chalkboard and check into a run play? I'll also be interested to see, because I would imagine Green Bay would rather them run the ball, even if they run it down their throats. It takes, you know, the more times an offense runs a play, if that offense is better than you, then the more chances that offense has at making a mistake. And if you're the defense, that's really your only hope in this game, because Green Bay is not going to line up and just make Atlanta punt 8 times in this one. They know that. So long drives are not the worst thing, because at least Atlanta's having to earn their yards. And Atlanta is a big-time chunk yardage team, and Green Bay's given up a ton of big plays. So I would think Green Bay is going to hope Atlanta runs the ball in this one, and they'll line up in ways to try to invite that and try to get them to do that.
Andy, anything else on the NFC game?
No, we're good to go here.
The 10 Things Mailbag starts now.
All right, Andy, let's jump into the mailbag then. As always, we do the mailbag on Thursday. If you want to ask questions, you can send it via Twitter, Andy_Benoit, GGrambling_SI. You can also send it on Facebook. You'll have to search our names. We're both on there. Facebook's great. You can ask questions that are as long as you want, or you can send them to talkback@themmqb.com. Just put podcast somewhere in the question or subject or whatever you got. A little bit of housekeeping before we get into it. The 500 game, we put out the poll, and 65% said yes, it does exist. Only 35% said that Andy has gone mad. Had it gone the other way, if like 52% said no, they hadn't heard of it, you would have had to come on here and admit you made it up, Andy.
Well, didn't go that way. We're even now. I don't owe you any year's salary, because this was the bet, right?
This was
the double or nothing bet.
That wasn't the bet we made.
I'll
just say one more time, I'm shocked this many people had recess with Andy Benoit when you were growing up. The bet we made was the Texans play selection, pass versus run, before the game got outside of double digits. Texans passed 22 times, rushed 13 times in the first half. If you want to back it up to before the game, Deion Lewis made it 14-3. They had 13 passes, 7 rushes. That was the bet we made. So you won that bet.
I thought you'd
owe me a second year salary here, because I value our friendship, and because I'm the bigger man, quite frankly. I will tell you that you don't have to call HR and have your direct deposit redirected to me. I will take care of that. But don't expect to get any money from Time Inc. until January 2019 or so.
Avoiding HR might be worth giving up the salary for. That's a pretty nice perk in that deal.
It is. One more thing, free kicks. We talked a little bit of free kicks on the Monday show, and we both thought Neil Rackers had been the last one. We were completely wrong. Shout out to Doug Rose, who sent us the actual last one on video. It was Mason Crosby versus the Lions in 2008. James Stafford was also on Twitter, @JP Stafford, was nice enough to send us the list, which was I mean, it was right there on the internet, and it was also very nice of him to not say, you two idiots should have, you know, done a Google search before you talked about it.
We didn't. In our defense, we didn't know. The free kick didn't make it down in our outline. We didn't know we'd get into the kick discussion. And who was the first guy? Rose?
You said Doug Rose, yeah.
Doug Rose sent a video of it, too, so I got to watch Mason Crosby. He came up just a few yards short on a 69-yard free kick. There was no tee. Remember, I didn't know if you could kick it off a tee. So what it's like is it looks like a kickoff, both sides, the kick return and the kickoff team on there. But instead of a tee, there's one guy holding it. So it looks like a really windy kickoff. And you try to kick it through the uprights. It's an improvised game almost.
Yeah. No one's made one since 1976. That was a 45-yarder for Ray Wershing, Chargers Bills. But most of these are, there's been 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, 7, 8 since then, and they've all been very long. They've all been 60, 70 yards, except for the late Rob Baronis missed a 58-yarder back in 2005.
Well, and if you think about it, you get a free kick because you call fair catch as time expires in the half. So in order to call fair catch and have it be within reasonable field goal range, someone would have to punt the ball. They'd have to, like, shank it without shanking it out of bounds. So that's why you're not going to see any. All these free kicks are going to be super long because nobody's going to punt from their own end zone and have it go 30 yards to the other team. I mean, I would hope they'd know better than that.
Yep. Well, there you go. So now actual mailbag questions right here. First one's going to come from Jake from London via Facebook. Why, oh, why did Denver not hire Kyle Shanahan? He was the perfect guy to improve their offense. Two, even more so because they needed O-line personnel upgrades aside. They actually already run a version, less sophisticated version of the system he runs in Atlanta. And three, he could have kept Wade Phillips in place. I will let you get into the X's and O's thing, Andy. I will say, look, those of us in the media, especially who are quite frankly not as smart and savvy as Andy, we love our narratives, and we love the narrative of Kyle Shanahan, you know, the guy who, you know, when he was a kid, he played catch with John Elway when his dad was coaching Elway, and, you know, what a great story of reuniting this would have been of Shanahan going back to Denver. But they went Vance Joseph instead, and they got Mike McCoy, a very good offense coordinator, and they also brought in Bill Musgrave. So they're just like an AFC West reunion going on there. But Andy, tell me about the Kyle Shanahan, let's for now call it a missed opportunity in Denver.
Well, I totally agree with the email and the premise of it. I had the same thoughts. Shanahan runs what Kubiak runs. They could have kept Wade Phillips, keep the thing afloat. Shanahan's a young coach. John Elway knows Kyle Shanahan very well, and he chose not to hire him. And Kyle Shanahan got other interviews, and other teams chose not to hire him, and ultimately Shanahan has what I think, and I don't mean to be disparaging to anyone here, but I think he's settled for what's without question the worst head coaching job in the NFL right now. He's going to take San Francisco. So the hottest head coaching candidate settled for the worst head coaching job, and on the way there, he was passed over by someone who knows him exceptionally well. Something's off there. There's something there that we don't know about that goes on behind the scenes that has impacted the situation, and we'd only be guessing at it, but that's where it is. From the outside looking in, it's bizarre he's not coaching Denver, but these decisions aren't made from the outside looking in, as they should be. They're made from the inside looking in. That's the right way to make that decision.
There's also, and it should be said, and people lose track of this, head coach is a much different role than offensive coordinator. And the Broncos had a guy in Josh McDaniels who was the young hotshot, play designer, offensive coordinator coming out of New England a couple years ago, and that obviously didn't work out for various reasons, and Josh probably wasn't ready for a head coaching gig. I think he would admit that now. I think he's ready now, and I'm surprised I'm not terribly surprised, but a little bit surprised that he wouldn't be willing to take one of these this offseason, but looks like he is staying put.
The coaches, when I've had a chance to ask a head coach who's turned into a coordinator, back to coordinator or vice versa or whatever, one of the questions I always like to ask these guys is, what percent, let's say as a coordinator, your job is 100% about football. It's not, but let's just for the sake of discussion say it's all football. When you become a head coach, then what percent of the job is still about football and what percent of it are other things unrelated? And almost all of them say it's about 70% football as a head coach, and then there's 30% of new stuff that you don't do. And I haven't asked a ton of guys, so it's not fine science here, but it seems
new,
to be...
New stuff is a very nice way of putting it, too.
And that's, yeah, and that's the nicest most of these guys put it. It's talking to people like us that's a big deal to them.
Yes.
It's the media obligations of being a head coach in part. But anyway, the job, it's not, you're right. Head coach is a very different job than coordinator. And there have been a number of great coordinators in the NFL who aren't going to be going to the Hall of Fame as that because they became failed head coaches. I'm thinking like Dom Capers, for example, or Dick LeBeau, guys that really revolutionized the game as coordinators, but their records, you know, we don't look at them that way. They're not going to be remembered in Canton because we only look at head coaches, even though it's such a different job.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, we will have, let's call it a medium dive at least, if not a deep dive, on all the new coaches on an upcoming show. We'll either do it, I know we lied and we said we do it this show, but we're going to push it back at least one show. We'll do it on Monday or we will do it on Thursday. But I promise... Andy and I will both promise right now we will do it by next Thursday's show, no later than that. This next question is also a coaching question. This is Nick from London. London, they're all wondering about the coaches out in London. How do the styles of Anthony Lynn and Ken Whisenhunt tie up working together on a single offense? More generally, how does a new offensively minded head coach go about working with an inherited OC who might run a different system? You know, as far as Anthony Lynn goes, and by the way, if you want to know more about Anthony Lynn, Jenny Brentis did a great story on him back in September. It is on the MMQB. That was long, long ago when Anthony Lynn was a mere position coach back on Labor Day or so. You know, Lynn is... I don't know how much you'd say he has sort of his own system, his own identity. He was a running backs coach. Obviously, you're coming in there, and Phillip Rivers is your quarterback. You know, I don't think this was keeping Whisenhunt in place. I don't think a remedy for the Chargers was redesigning this offense, and I think Lynn was smart enough to realize that.
I was at the Combine last year, and I was going to meet with Anthony Lynn. I think he'd be comfortable with me sharing this. And I saw Pep Hamilton across the room, and as I was waiting, and I went over and talked to him, and he mentioned that he said, well, there are only really like four or five different running plays in football anyway. And I went back to Lynn and said, hey, Pep Hamilton has some fighting words. He said, there's only four or five different run plays. What do you think of that as a running back coach? And he said he agreed with that. He said, yeah, he's kind of right. Yeah. There's inside zone, outside zone, gap scheme, and you know, it's not a lot of stuff. So Lynn understands that, and that it's a passing league, and he's also very humble, and he made this clear. He's not a running mindset guy unless he needs to be. If he feels he's got a better passing offense, which with Phillip Rivers, that's what you have, then he's going to pass the football. And Ken Whisenhunt's a great designer of the passing game. Lynn, no matter how smart of a football guy he is not going to be as refined as Whisenhunt is because Lynn's been working at the running backs for many years now, and that's the position he played. So I like this. It's a humble move, and it's a move they needed to keep in place. And I think Whisenhunt will run that show, and Lynn will probably sprinkle in his running game designs here and there.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'll say one more thing about Anthony Lynn. We'll talk about him a little bit more next week. But you know, when people say players, coaches, that tends to be, you know, it tends to imply sort of a guy who's not a disciplinarian or you know is someone who can be walked over a little bit, or maybe, you know, in some circles it's sort of code for an African American coach. Lynn is an exceptional teacher, and you know, the guys they sort of brought into Buffalo in their backfield, they all wanted to play for him. They all got better for him. There was a story he coached a guy who had a learning disability, and so he had I believe it was Carlisle Jones record himself calling out plays and sort of use it to quiz this guy. And he's a creative teacher. He's a really good teacher. And guys will play for him, and they will play well for him. I don't like anything the Chargers did this offseason as far as the move goes and all that. But Lynn is a he's going to be a good head coach. I don't know if it'll be right off the bat, but he was a good hire. He's a good addition there. This next one is coming from Eric Melikari via Facebook. He wants to know our thoughts on the Cowboys' spike at the end of the divisional round game on that final drive before Bailey's game-tying field goal. Of course, they left 35 seconds on the clock, which was enough for Aaron Rodgers to lead that late drive. Andy, were you moved by this at all?
Yeah, I was. When I watched the game live, I remember saying out loud, why would you spike the ball there? Not so much because you might leave Rodgers time. You don't know that that's going to happen at that point. You've still got a lot of football on your end to play on offense there. But just because you give away a down, and it was a kind of a weird spot in the field to spike it. So it just didn't – nothing felt right about it. But that was the decision they made. They still had opportunities to execute, and they you know, they didn't lose that game. Green Bay won that game, too. Dallas played well offensively. Their coverage was fine. Rodgers made some otherworldly plays. But, yeah, I did raise my eyebrow at that, certainly, the spike.
Yeah, I feel like there was a little bit of panic, you know, rookie QB, and granted, Dax more than a rookie QB at this point, but yeah, your young QB hasn't been in that sort of, you know, late panic situation much, and maybe you just want to, you know, sort of take a minute, sort of reset and be able to go. But yeah, it was a mistake. No doubt it was a mistake, and certainly fans love getting on coaches about clock management, because anyone who has ever played Madden can probably manage the clock as well as your typical NFL coach.
Let me remind you, though, we always have this. The Madden, you can pause the game and think your way through it if you have to. The NFL coaches don't have a pause button.
That is true. But you'd figure they'd have a specialist on the sideline at this point. Who they
yeah,
would just say, tell me
do.
What to do.
Yep. And some of them do. You're right.
This next one is coming from Joseph Conroy via Facebook. Andy had mentioned how rare it was for two corners to be up in press coverage on one receiver, which is what the Packers had done against Odell Beckham a little bit. Why doesn't it happen more often against teams that have one clear-cut great receiver, DeAndre Hopkins, Julio Jones, or an A.J. Green before Tyler Eifert came back? Also, does it only work with 5+ defensive backs when the opposition doesn't have a decent running game? # big in Australia, which is redundant at this point because everybody knows that. But Andy, what do you think?
Well, the reason you don't see it more is because it's so aggressive. You leave cover zero everywhere else, or almost everywhere else. You only have one safety, so there's at least three defenders who have absolutely no help anywhere, so they have to play as if it's cover zero. And most teams, when you're going cover zero, it means you're blitzing. So you get all the downside of the coverage, but none of the upside with the blitz element. That's the first part. The reason, when you do see it, and it's rare, you see it in the red zone, because in the red zone, the sidelines and the back end zone line, they kind of become an extra defender. So you can play cover zero there a little bit more, because the back line is essentially a safety all the way across. So you'll see it in the red zone, but it's not something, I don't think I've ever seen it done in the field where you're out beyond the 20 yard line anywhere.
All right. This one's coming from Lincoln from Richmond. I'm a Pats fan and excited about all their offensive options. Martellus Bennett, Malcolm Mitchell, Danny Amendola, Edelman, Floyd, White, Lewis, Blunt. But wondering if they don't add up to the sum of their parts. So many are complementary pieces at this point in their careers. And I, being Lincoln, am concerned about the absence of the gravity-bending presence of Gronk. Will they be as dangerous? Is it better to have a couple of blue chippers surrounded by average talent like Pittsburgh has, or what the Patriots have, where you have a bunch of puzzle pieces, basically, is what New England has at this point?
They do, but they have one guy who's not a puzzle piece, and he's the one that feeds the ball to all those guys.
Yeah.
So I would advise Lincoln, you know, I wouldn't worry about it. Your team averaged 27.6 points a game this season. It's still a prolific offense. I don't think there's anything – and I get the question. I'm not saying it's a bad question, but let's not forget the Tom Brady factor.
Yeah. And look, you know, when you have Brady back there and you have, quite frankly, you know, a bunch of sort of versatile puzzle pieces – they can kind of, you know, they're a little bit of a chameleon type of offense here. They can go with the, you know, they can line up Blunt behind Devlin and go with the power running game. You can throw White out there and go five wide. You can go Lewis, and then Lewis gives you the flexibility, a little more flexibility than the other two guys, where you can put him out wide, or you can flex him back into the backfield. And that's, you know, when Brady's your quarterback as well, that's something that a lot of teams don't have, that kind of flexibility to sort of be a different team week to week, or even play to play. The last one is coming from Joris via TalkBack, and I'm sorry if I just butchered your first name, Joris. You guys mentioned a lot of zone blocking versus man blocking schemes, very seems the NFL. Annie, can you give a team that uses exclusively zone blocking, or at least on the vast majority of their plays, and a team that uses exclusively man blocking? And when looking at these teams on film, what would you see to recognize one versus the other?
The exclusive zone blocking team would be Seattle, although they did three man blocking run plays against Detroit, which I guess constituted the big changeup that everybody was asking Pete Carroll about after the game. But they're a zone blocking team. The man blocking team would be Buffalo. And what you see with man blocking, that's where you see pull blockers. Blockers go individually on the move to locate a specific defender. And it's called gap scheme or man block. I call it man blocking because I think it's easier to think in your head, hey, that's not zone blocking, which is all gap scheme is not zone blocking. Zone team, the whole offensive line moves in unison, and you try to stretch to the outside and get one cut downhill and go. It's the Denver Broncos old running scheme that we hear a lot about. And then what these teams that are remaining do well, New England, Pittsburgh, Green Bay as well, and I think what we talked about Atlanta's going to do is inside zone. And just to confuse everybody, inside zone is kind of both. It's man and zone. And I've heard some coaches call it one and some coaches call it the other. All inside zone is basically is two double teams at the point of attack, and it's right up the middle. It's called, that's an inside zone run called duo. So duo is the run you'll see most this weekend, and that's the running game. And that kind of circles back. We just, as Anthony Lynn said, that's the running game now. That's all you got in the NFL or any level of football.
All right. And with that, we're going to wrap up the show. Mailbag, send the mailbag questions, especially with the offseason coming up. We're going to answer just, I don't know, thousands upon thousands of mailbag questions. Whatever you have questions about, send them. Andy _ Benoit, GGremling _SI. Again, Facebook is great. We're both on Facebook. You can write whatever, your 2,000-word missive on there, or you can email talkback@themmqb.com. We'll be back with our Monday show, and we'll break down everything that happens on Sunday. And like I said, we'll either do coaches on Monday or we'll do it on Thursday, but we will do it within the next week. We will finally get to it. Thank you very much to our producer Matt Havia and editor Chris Basil. Digital media guys always making us sound so good. Jeff Irwin, our researcher, helping us out, making us sound smart. Most of all, thank you to all of you for listening to this episode of the MMQB 10 Things podcast. We want to hear from you. Send your stuff, even if you don't have questions. Send your comments. Make them nice comments. I'm tired of getting criticized here. Remember to listen to and subscribe to new episodes and archived episodes of the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer, the MMQB podcast with Peter King, and this podcast, the MMQB 10 Things podcast, wherever you listen to podcasts. That includes the MMQB.com, SI.com, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We will see you guys first thing Monday morning.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.